Okay, let's begin. We're not doing too bad. We're only 2.5 weeks behind. That isn't too bad. I'd like to certainly get through purposiveness and maybe necessity today, and then I think we'll probably do just 1 week on the deduction, since we've already covered a lot of what's going to be involved in it. So the deduction. Last time we just did paragraph 9. And just to summarize, we looked at 3 3/4 interpretations of it. The first, the cognitive interpretation by Dwyer, in which all the emphasis was on the relationship between the imagination and the understanding, and then a reflection on that, but just one pleasure derived in the reflection on the object. We then went in, as it were, the opposite direction in Hanne Ginsborg's account, in which we saw that the pleasure was derived from, there's a self-referential account in which the pleasure was derived from one judging the object as it ought to be judged, and therefore as, so that the universal communicability of the judgment was the source of the pleasure. And the difficulty we found in that account was that it seemed to leave out the object. Allison did not attempt to tie all the ends together and give an answer to the problem, but rather signaled towards the thought that the harmony between the imagination and the understanding are the subjective conditions for the possibility of objective judgment. And then with Longmanes, she combined, I suggested, both the epistemological orientation of Dwyer, which essentially is a ideal predictive account that says roughly that everyone ideally will agree with my judgment, and the strong normativity of Ginsborg's account, everyone ought to agree with my judgment, and said that there were pleasures in both moments such that the two parts, the normative and the epistemological, reinforced one another, but were nonetheless independent moments. And my objection to that was one pleasure too many. That is, it really did depend on the two pleasures. I promised last week that I would say a bit more about Ginsborg and her account of concept acquisition. And I want to start with that today. How she uses her account of the self-referentiality of my taking something to be beautiful, and uses that idea of normativity in order to generate a generalized account of concept acquisition. And why should we be interested in this? Well, because if you go back to our accounts of reflective judgment, it turns out that we never did solve what is the inevitable problem of abstraction. Namely, when I am judging a particular object reflectively, that is, an object that I don't know the universal of which, the question always occurs,
how do I know what features of that object to pick out so that I can look for resemblances between it and some other object? So the general problem of concept acquisition, I mean, concepts are general. They have to apply to more than one object. And the difficulty is, how do we generalize from individual cases? How do we discover that something we're looking at is an object of any kind when we don't already have that notion of kind in our repertoire of concepts? And the notion of schematism or schema-like doesn't do the trick, because it doesn't explain why I should take one feature rather than another of the object as the ones that need to be generalized. And why look at the branches of a tree rather than the color of its bark? How do we discriminate what features to generalize? Longuenesse's answer, which we tried out, was, well, we're always heading towards universality, because we're always heading towards making the object fit into our paradigm of judgment. But that just begs the question. It doesn't tell us still what features and why. How do we generalize? How do we make our awareness of a single object something that can be the beginning of a general account? Well, in a surprising way, Ginsburg decides to go back to Hume, and her general strategy is to combine a Humean account, a Humean, I'll explain how it works, a Humean dispositional account with a Kantian normative account. So she says, when we look at an individual object in front of us, when we perceive it, that it is, and I quote her, a basic psychological effect about us that our association of ideas follow a certain regular pattern. So that, for example, when I see a triangle, I automatically associate that triangle with all the other triangles I've seen. That is, the way in which, and she says this is a primitive fact about how the human imagination works, I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. But she says that the structure of our of associations is such that when we see a triangle, we think of other triangles we have seen, and not, for example, squares and circles and the man on the moon. That we automatically are tripped off to remember, if you wish, resemblances. And it is, she says, because of natural patterns of association, that once the word triangle has been applied to a representative sample, we will become disposed to apply it to triangles generally. And relatedly, that when we entertain hypotheses involving the word triangle, it is precisely ideas of triangles that we are disposed to call to mind as potential counterexamples. Finding a resemblance, she suggests, does not precede the acquisition of the corresponding disposition. Rather, acquiring the disposition is just what finding the resemblance consists in. Let me say that again. This is a strong associationist account. That we don't
look for resemblances and then form a disposition to associate that object with those resembling cases. Rather, we form the association. We form the disposition to think of all the triangles we have seen when we see a particular triangle, and acquiring that disposition is what resemblance consists in. So resemblance is a consequence of association and not a condition for it. Well, that by itself, of course, is not enough. That's just a version of psychological nominalism. So she needs to say something more. Think of the question this way. Why should the representational character of a particular idea be transformed by a state of readiness to call to mind other particular ideas into a universal norm, that is, the generality? Why does that count as generality at all? Her answer is that by itself, that is not a count of generality. Hume hasn't done it. We need to add something else. And the something else she suggests is that the awareness of my own state of readiness, rather than the particular idea itself, is what constitutes the possession of the general idea. Let me say that again. It is my attitude toward this idea, namely, my own state of readiness to think of it as a general idea, that makes it a general idea. That is, generality is equal to my readiness to call to mind like objects and conceive of them as having normative force. So and this is the normative twist. The normative twist states, to use the Kantian example, that my perception of a tree not only involves my being in a state of readiness to call to mind what Kant calls reproduce representations of other trees, it involves my taking it that, insofar as I do call ideas of other trees to mind, I am doing what I and everyone else ought to be doing under these circumstances. That is, I am the generality of my disposition lies not in the rules and not in the content, but is incorporated into my perception, and it is incorporated into my perception through seeing the tree as a tree in virtue of my awareness that my readiness to associate this tree with other trees is appropriate given my perceptual situation. So it's the introduction exactly as she did in the case of beauty, the rule governess, the generality in my associations is not a function of the rules themselves, but a function of my taking my representations to be rule governed. And this is exactly what she said about the case of beauty. That is, because the whole point about the case of beauty is it's groundless. That is, it's not based on rules. Rather, the normativity derives from, and this is what makes beauty interesting, that Kant wants to make room for the possibility of normative claims that do not presuppose existing rules. Right? This is the great anti-Platonic move. And you cannot go anti-Platonic unless you're willing to have the possibility, I'm suggesting, of thinking about the possibility of normative claims that do not suppose is the existing specific rules. And then Kant's way of handling this is that our entitlement to make judgments of beauty appears to depend on our being entitled to take a normative attitude toward our mental activity generally. And in taking a normative attitude generally, we are saying what we think everyone ought to say. Okay, let me try to put this in a number of theses. I can see the puzzle. I read this as a four-part account of the possibility of concept acquisition. At the first level, the claim is we are hardwired to form dispositions to associate X with previous X's. That is, when I see a tree, I am hardwired, I am triggered, on her account, to think of other trees I've seen. Now, I think the hardwired, there are good reasons to think that there's something right about this. That is, we know that babies, very early on, we now think within the first hours after being born, can both discriminate between persons and objects, can follow objects, and so on and so forth. That is, there's a bit of hardwiring. And she's saying, along with the hardwiring to discriminate objects from events, from flashes of light and the like, there is a hardwired disposition to associate one perception with, let's call it, morphologically like perceptions. I want to add a second thesis to this. And I want to say, well, we're not simply physically hardwired. When you say the hardwired is a function of evolution, I want to say that we have
cultural and anthropological constraints on the way in which we pick out objects. What I mean by that is the following. That if you are a baby, you will be particularly alert to things that look like mother's breasts, smiling faces, things that make interesting noises. In other words, you will first, at the evolutionary level, pick up those things. You will then, as things go, you will then be interested in things you can handle and grasp. But then, the question is, what objects are your parents showing you? And they're going to be showing you objects that are repeatably significant for the culture you belong to. So they may show you particular types of toys or particular types of utensils and the like. Stanley Cavell famously says, when he talks about rule following, that rule following depends, he says, on the entire world of the fact that we share routes of interest, things we find equally amusing, things that we find we all need. We can go on and on. That is, that the world appears the way it does is overdetermined by evolution and culture as making certain objects salient in our environment. That saliency is what is going to govern the dispositions of association. The dispositions of associating, I'm taking this hardwired, I'm saying that it's further constrained by these structures of saliency. All of this is absolutely empiricist. All of this is a version of you. It's step three that is the normative twist. And the normative twist states that when I form such a disposition, say to when I see that umbrella, to imagine all the various umbrellas I've seen, I take it that my disposition is as it ought to be. So the generality derives not from the association, but from my giving those associations the standing of seeing things as they ought to be seen. Now, what follows from seeing things as they ought to be seen? And here's the step that Hinzborg leaves out, but I take to be absolutely fundamental. If I take it that when I see the umbrella and see it as an instance of umbrellahood, then I can only cash out my belief in three by forming two kinds of rules, namely schema rules and rules of inference. That is the implication of taking my representative vision to be normative is to attempt to generate a schema of umbrellas and to underpin that schema with rules of inference. Namely, umbrellas are a version of what keeps you dry, blah, blah, blah. So that rule following, the rules, all the heavy stuff that people always talk about
conceptual relationships and the rules of schematic formation are the last step in a developmental sequence. And what makes it possible? So the great question of normativity here is answered by the self-referential thesis, and then only gets, as it were, made explicit by the series of rule-following activities. Now, I've never seen the count of concept acquisition like this, but it has a certain, I think, general power and elegance to it. And this moment would not operate, could not kick in, unless something like the case of beauty were possible. That is, to think of cases where normativity is not underpinned by rules. That's what gives us access to this as an autonomous moment. That's Ginsburg's thesis. Yeah?
I guess maybe this is a very simple question.
Yeah.
At what level do we have mutual understanding? And by that I mean, how do we know we're sharing the same concept? Because if we're getting the generality based on our taking our associations as they ought to be, then how do I know my takings about my associations match up in some, you know, either exact or loose way with others' takings? And as far as I can see, it either must be at the level of inference, or it must be at the level of the hardwiring, or both, maybe.
If
at the level of the hardwiring, why not just say certain concepts are innate?
So the answer is we only know it blatantly at four. But the point is four has this force, that is, that it does coordinate our views, only because we are both committed already at three. That is, it's only because I'm thinking, but surely this is a model that you're using counterexamples has any force to it. So that the question is why. You may think of this, by the way, as a neo-Aristotelian account, right? Because what it is it follows exactly what Aristotle says about ethics. It's all about habit and habituation and acquiring things implicitly, and then only explicitly at a secondary reflective level, where I'm claiming the reflective level is now the rule stuff. So that what is happening at these levels is a training, but a training which has this Kantian moment to it. And it's that Kantian moment that impels us to take seriously other people's views, that we need to coordinate our takings with their takings. Because we've already thinking that I'm seeing things as they ought to be seen. And therefore, I'm committed to rules, which are now not magical, but are making explicit of my already given normative relationship to my perceptual states. Adam? I'll let you ponder. No. Look, this is new to me as much to you, right? This is a new thesis, and it's interesting. Adam?
I was wondering why.
I don't know if it's true or not either. It's an absolute, but it's fascinating.
I'm wondering why you call the moments of normative twists the autonomic thesis, because it just sort of seems, if you read this developmentally, the same sorts of practices, cultural practices that govern let's say the initial context of salience, so the initial development of associations, will just be mimetically reproduced, let's say, at the third moment. And so I can't quite see how.
Yeah, but.
Autonomy.
But salience won't give you generality. You get back to psychological nominalism. That's just the way I perceive things. I find myself thinking this. So this is the old Humean problem that he can't ratchet out of his, his associations and regularities and dispositions. Nothing comes out normative, and therefore nothing comes out as capable of serious criticism. Right? So the problem of empiricism, which tries to do everything through steps 1 and 2, is it just ends up, as we know with everything in you, with regularities. And regularities are nice, but then what you end up with is behaviorism. So if we want to move from either some form of regularity or behaviorism to something in which criticism and rational reflection matters in the appropriate way, we have to get beyond this type of material.
Yeah, I think maybe criticism, or you were trying to get at, was something about how this structure seems to, how does it connect? If there's an ought perspective we take on objects, and then I say it's a bottle, and you say it's a bottle, or you say it's somebody else, and then in this negotiation, we're both taking it from a certain perspective, but how then do we negotiate and unify our concepts or not? And
you just gave the answer.
But how does that judgment, what's the basis that it ends up going one way and we agree on something or we disagree? Even if we both presuppose that there is, we're both approaching it as if there ought to be a concept for it, then it seems like there's a psychic element, psychological.
Can I talk this slightly differently?
Sure.
How do we know we're not having merely created misunderstandings about what we mean?
Maybe this is something else, but I'm thinking a lot about Kojev, and he talks about desire for desire, and I'm curious if that connects to this.
The issue of creative misunderstandings presupposes there's something real, namely bottleness, that we can check our notions of bottled against. The Kantian Copernican turn is there is nothing more to taking something to be a bottle other than the fact that we generate an authoritative rule that, with a schema and rules of inference, that's what bottles are. So the notion of creative misunderstanding is itself that, as it were, the realist ghost that's haunting your imaginary, as if there's something more that we want, right? But this is to give up. So what you have to add to this to make it more interesting than Ginsburg does is you need roughly some Hegelian story about a history of criticism and development and all of that. But nonetheless, this is a truly Copernican account of concept acquisition, because it says that, or even Wittgensteinian, I can imagine Wittgensteinian thinking that this stuff is the form of life stuff, right? This is going to be what gets us into the normative domain with relationship to our experiences, and then we cash them out in terms of schema rules and rules of inference. And there's nothing more. That is, there's nothing you can say, is that the right rule for bottle? Well, it's the rule for bottle. And if the negotiation fails, just like if I say this is beautiful and I cannot get you to agree, maybe we just have to walk away from one another. You say this is civilization, I say it's a disgrace before God. Right? So maybe we pull out the bombs. But to think that we're going to find the real fact of the matter. Right? But, I'm trying to say that this is a really Copernican analysis. That's what I'm trying to get. I'm trying to, and what it does is give the bootstrapping, what I like about it, is it has three or four distinct components. A psychological component, an anthropological cultural component, a normative component, and a separate rule-following component. That is, it's bringing together all the different levels at which people are tempted to analyze concepts, either as psychological dispositions, or as rules, or as pure normativity, you know, and it tries to let the moment of normativity itself, as it were, be the coordinating or the swing moment between the empirical stuff and the rule-following stuff. So it's a deeply synthetic account, right? I can see lots of questions. Yeah.
I'm just wondering how the pure concepts of the understanding are going to, where we're going to trace them back to. It seems like they could be traced back either to one or
two. She does it at one. So the association connects with, and it's all in economy, there's a variation on both the reproductive imagination, right? And then, just if you want to think about Hardwired, you've already read something relevant to that today, what Kahn calls aesthetic standard ideas. Does anyone recall what standard aesthetic ideas are? Yeah, and it's a form of association in a Humean way. So you can think that step one is simply a combination of the reproductive imagination and aesthetic standard ideas. Step two provides constraints on that, generating deeper structures of salience, orientation, and the like, etc. Yeah.
Now, if you said the number three, the normative twist, is sort of predicated on a similar judgment of the judgment of the reader.
That's her whole thesis, right?
That's
her big deal. But she wants to use this, strangely enough, the idea of the beautiful, as a key to the whole structure of
concept acquisition. So my question is our, when we apprehend an object in the object as object, is the predicate or is the possibility of predicating it beautiful always there? Do we have a way to differentiate it? Or is the possibility of beauty something kind of like the Wittgensteinian predicate of life, that we sort of inherently understand something to be possibly beautiful or not? And if we can't parse this, how is that awareness, how can we really be aware of what?
That's the issue of the deduction of taste. So that's where we have to figure out where beauty comes in. At the moment, I'm just saying she uses her self-referential account of the normative status to lever this stuff. Nothing about this explains anything about beauty, right? Doesn't help with beauty at all. It just happens that a moment of the logic of the beautiful helps with the notion of concept acquisition. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if we take a different model of concept acquisition, how this would respond. And so if you take the standard Chomsky model, the problem with the empirical level is going to be something like the poverty of stimulus. So at that level, there's a lack of stimuli that can account for all these concepts that we get. And so the way I imagine, so that's one question. The second question is, it would seem that someone like a Chomskyan would claim that she's begging the question by putting the normative twist in the place in which it is, that it would need to be something like some psychological or innate kind of thing. That the question here is, how does that twist get kicked on so that without falling back into the poverty of the stimulus problem?
Well, I'm trying to answer the poverty of the stimulus problem by adding to the hard wiring the cultural anthropological stuff. Right? That is, I'm simply saying we're hardwired in roughly a Kantian way, but then we need to narrow that down. And so, again, you know, if I'm an Eskimo, then early on I'm going to be oriented toward different meanings of snow that you and I wouldn't know what they were talking about, right? But that's not a property of stimulus. It's the stimulus is there. What narrows it down is culture, situation, you know, all that kind of stuff.
But I guess the problem here is that the issue is the associative element in which for concept acquisition, there needs, on this model, which the Chomsky model would say, no, there is no associative moment in which we go through this process of seeing an umbrella and thinking about all the other umbrellas that we have. That's exactly what we can't account for because of the poverty of stimulus. That's the problem. So,
and
so the cultural anthropological level would still run into that issue, nonetheless.
Yeah. Don't see why. That's my answer. I don't see why, with enough of this and this, long as this has sufficient stuff about needs, nurturing, all that kind of stuff, to run into that problem. What I don't like about the Chomskyan is it's supposing that rules are the normative stuff. Right? It's another Platonic thesis. And where does it come from? Magic! Right? I mean, the thing about this is it doesn't have any magic in it. Right? It's a very disenchanted and deflationary view that tries to get as much as it can with using a lot of different stuff, but actually in a minimalist way. And that's the appeal to me. Whether it works or not, I don't know, but that's the appeal.
It all relies on normativity. You start with itself, right?
Yeah.
But on a level of normativity. But I'm still not convinced about this normativity bootstrapping itself.
Right, but I mean, that's what, I mean, so her thought is, if you buy the story about beauty, right, then you'll be inclined to make sense of this moment. That is, what makes us think that this moment can't operate is that we always seem to be in the midst of either regularities, empiricism, or Platonism, right? And we don't know how to, as it were, sort out the relationship between the minimalism of the one, is reductivism, and the inflationary metaphysics of the other, right? And she's saying, well, if you're willing to buy that part of what is at stake is we do make normative claims without being backed by rules, then we have a chance of thinking about normativity in a different way. That's her hypothesis. Yeah?
In this example of Wittgenstein uses where there's a drawing and it could be a rabbit or it could be a duck, and the bill of the rabbit could be the bill of the duck could be the ears of the rabbit.
Yep.
And then people, like one person looks at it and they go through one through three seeing a rabbit and yep. Another
yep.
If it's a beautiful picture of that, then that's something else entirely, right?
Yep. No, I mean, nothing's going to solve that other than at this level, and even this level won't sort it out, right? Because unless way back here I can go through the, you know, shift of perception. If I never go through, I mean, you know, there are some of those trick things where I look at them, I can't see the lady, I just see the vase. I don't, you know. And that you can say it's a trick thing, well, you really tricked me, because I don't see it. But of course, that's bottoming out. And none of this is going to solve that. Right? I agree with that. But that's just to alert us to the difficulties at this level, right? Yeah.
I have an objection made to step three, which is that it already seems up to its ears in conceptuality. That is, if I'm taking certain associations that I have, then in order to correlate them, it seems to me that I already need some concept of likeness or similarity or identity on which to draw in order to bring them together, to take them as general. Otherwise, what would my taking them consist in? I mean, there must be some no. feature or criterion that I'm using.
No, I'm saying saying the criterion. Yeah.
But then how does the work of generality get done? It's that
I think when I see the umbrella as an umbrella, right, that I'm seeing it as it ought to be seen. Now I've got a commitment. You say to me, wait a minute, why do you think that? And now in order to back up my sense that I'm perceiving the world as it ought to be perceived with the requisite generality, I cash it out by schema rules and rules of inference. It doesn't rely on them. Rather, they are the making explicit of the commitments. So commitments is, it's my commitments of taking something as something, right, that's doing the hard work. And therefore, commitment, that's another word for saying I'm seeing it as it ought to be seen, right? Is as it were what gives the cashing out its power on this account. Okay. One last go, then we ought to move on since we haven't mentioned 13. Call for an hour. No, I mean exactly what third critique is about is how these different, let's call it aesthetic features of experience, relate to other features of experience. Because if they don't relate at all, then we'll just all go home or go to the museum or something, right? We're trying to figure out what their force is. And their force here is a deepening of Copernicanism at the normative level.
Yeah. It seems like in three, just following on what I was saying, there's kind of like an implicit, very blind faith in our cultural or anthropological disposition, and then afterwards we make rules to back that up. Rational.
No, it's not like it, but you're right. It's unthinking. In other words, and of course, I don't think we do think. That is, I do think we are just, as it were, initiated into this stuff. And we do, so the suggestion is, yeah, this is how I see it, and I'm right to see it, and then we say, why are you right to see it? Well, because, right, I mean.
Why is that the autonomy thesis, and not just the inertia of sailing? Why isn't that just the inertia of sailing?
Because it comes to stake us to rational criticism, rational debate, negotiation, and coordination. Saying I'm seeing it as it ought to be seen is universality. That is all the heavy. That is the rationalism, the universality, the ethical stuff, is all in my taking myself to see things as they ought to be seen. That is, everyone else ought to agree with me. So I use my perceptions as exemplary of what perceiving this object should be. And I think if you look in your heart of arts, every one of us thinks that our perceptions are exemplary. That is, we are all certain kinds of I don't want to say it's not solipsism, it's the very opposite. We are all inflated legislators in a potential kingdom of ends. One might say. That's what she's saying. That it's taking our perceptions to be legislative. That's another way of putting it. And then the question is, can you imagine perceiving without taking your perceptions
to be legislative for what perceiving that object is. Well, it sounds crazy that you shouldn't, because if you don't think that, then you think, I'm seeing this, but who knows, I can elude it. No, we don't think that. That is, she's saying that the generality, the way universality enters, is via our normative commitment to the rightness of our own perceptual experience. Okay. Let's stop there. This will puzzle you and infuriate you, and just read the article and do what you want with it.
But what is this called?
I mean, what is it called?
These four steps.
An interesting thesis.
What's the article?
What? Ginsburg's theory of concept acquisition. She doesn't think of all four steps. She thinks there are just two. But she doesn't mention this. This is why it's, when you read her, it's infuriating.
So then you can name it something.
I just did.
Ginsburg's
theory of concept acquisition.
An interesting thesis.
An interesting thesis, right? A Kantian, Copernican, post-Kantian, yeah. It doesn't matter. Okay, let's talk about purposiveness. So, that's what I did this weekend. The third moment, right, we've got the moment of disinterestedness and universality, but we haven't said much, in fact, we've hardly said anything about the object of judgment and what the third moment, the moment of purposiveness, discusses is the character of the object suitable for universal communicable state of a harmony of the faculties. Now, to put it that way, that is, an object suitable for a universally communicable state, is to say we're not talking about the object, but the object qua represented. Right? This is Kant. We're never talking about the object itself. I mean, everything that makes this account Kantian, there's always got to be the subjective moment. Right? That's the Kantian insistence. So it's the object qua represented in mere reflection. So at 236, Kant sums up his account of this section. When he says, beauty, just the last sentence of the whole section, what is beauty? Beauty is an object's form of purposiveness insofar as it is perceived in the object without the presentation of a purpose. Purposiveness without purpose. Okay, let's see if we can figure out what that means. In paragraph 10, Kant says that purposiveness is originally thought of as a property of a concept. How
having a causality with respect to its object. And the object is thought of as a purpose. So my concept of dinner tonight is purposive in the sense that it will lead me to produce, with any luck, a dinner, and that dinner is the purpose. So the thought is that when we look at that dinner, say it's all nicely set out, right, a rack of lamb with, you know, parsley and mint sauce and roast potatoes, and what vegetables do you have with rack of lamb? No one knows. We've reached a bad state. String beans, don't we?
Sure.
Anyway, you look at that beautifully set out and you think, that cannot be a cosmic accident, right? That is the consequence of an intentional planned act. That is, we cannot look at that without thinking of it as a purpose that has been achieved through someone's conceptuality. Now, that gives us the notion of the purposiveness of a concept and gives us a content, the object produced. But this is aesthetics, and we're in a slightly different realm here. So Kant says toward the end of paragraph 10 that, well, let's read the second half of the second paragraph. He says, on the other hand, we do call object states of mind or acts purposive, even if their possibility does not necessarily presuppose the presentation of a purpose. We do this merely because we can explain and grasp them only if we assume that they are based on a causality that operates according to purposes, on a will that would have so arranged them in accordance with the presentation of a certain rule. So the next thought Kant has is sometimes we're struck by objects, and for the moment he's thinking both cultural and natural objects, both cultural and natural objects, that because of the complexity of their form, because of the intricacy of their arrangements as we experience it, we cannot but think of them as somehow the consequence of, let's call it, intelligent design, even if, and here's the crucial even if we have no idea what they were designed for. That is, something about their complexity is sufficient to kick off, let's call it, our purpose talk, even if we have, so he says, you know, the example he gives in the last footnote is the tulip, right? And the tulip, you know, you see the tulip, it's amazing, right? What's it for? Who knows what tulips are for? They're not for, I mean, you know. But nonetheless, we can only think of them as purposive, even if we cannot think and do not even know what it would mean to find what the purpose is that would explain their purposive look. Hence, he says, we can at least observe a purposiveness as to form and take note of it in objects, even if only by reflection, without basing it on a purpose. That is, what is form here? This is Kant's notion of form. It's not the same as form anywhere else. Form is simply the purposive look of something independent of our capacity or even desire to construe it as an actual purpose. So it has, so its purposiveness, we might say, its purposiveness is purpose without a content. That is, it's the look of something as purpose-like. That's the thesis he's going to try to push. And for reflective judgment, all purposiveness is without purpose, since logically, judging a purposiveness, since logically judging purposiveness would be making a determinate judgment. That is, if I say, oh, I know what the purpose of that is, it looks purposive, and it is, right? It's for the sake of, well, then it's on the aesthetic judgment, it's a logical judgment, right? Oh, yeah, it's I forget what they're called, but you eat off of them, right? A table. It only has the look of something that is intended, but it is a purpose. For the sake of aesthetics, therefore, we want purposiveness without purpose. Now, in paragraph 11, Kant argues to this end of purposiveness without purpose by showing that, by arguing by elimination from all the other possible grounds for our liking an object. Since we are having a we get disinterested pleasure from the object, then the object we perceive aesthetically has no subjective purpose. And furthermore, it has no objective purpose, that is, it's not for the sake of morality. And because it's aesthetic, it's not based on a concept. Ergo, the last sentence of paragraph 11, he says, therefore, the liking that, without a concept, we judge to be universally communicable, and hence to be the basis that determines a judgment of taste, can be nothing but the subjective purposiveness in the presentation of an object without any purpose, whether objective or subjective, and hence the mere form of purposiveness, insofar as we are conscious of it in the presentation by which an object is given to us. Why is he talking about purposiveness at all? Well, the first thought is that the form of purposiveness, which he's interested in, is the seeming as if design. So Kant says somewhere, we'll come to later, he says, when we look at nature, we conceive it as art. That is, it has the look of something as if designed, and artworks must have the look of something natural, that is, not explicitly intended.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is that about, is he really talking about like the criteria of individuation in, individuating factors? It seems like the notion of purposiveness almost seems like a supplement to like the notion of unifying particular center is not within a manifold in the first critique.
No, it's well, I mean, we'll come to this. I'm going to argue it has to be in excess of individuation. So he actually has something that is more than the minimum necessary condition for individuation at stake. Right? And that's his, I'll come to, but the obvious thing is all his arguments against regularity and all the like. So it can't be just that. He's not claiming there's an external purposiveness that originates. We'll come to some lack of it, but he's certainly not claiming that. Nor is he denying that with a bit of ingenuity we can treat anything as if purposive, but that won't give you beauty. I mean, this isn't kind of beauty. And he's trying to ask about what kinds of objects, what features of objects, as apprehended, do we experience as beautiful? And he's eliminated that we don't experience things as beautiful because we like them. The things we like, we just eat them. And, or the equivalent. And we don't get pleasure from them because they are morally worthy. If you're like me, you try to avoid them. We're interested in what aspects of the world strike us when we are so struck as beautiful. And since he's now eliminated the agreeable and the good, he is now trying to say, well, it's got to be the form of the object, because we've eliminated conceptuality as well. So it can only be form. Well, what kind of form? And he's going to say, those forms that strike us as purposive, and I'm going to say a bit more, a lot more, in fact, when we get to, let's talk about free beauty. Those forms that strike us as replete with form. I mean, just stuff with the stuff. And those are the ones that gather us, gather our attention.
So there's the counterexample of a pain that doesn't look like it has purposiveness and not just beautiful.
I'm going to talk later about why Cy Twombly and Kant probably had dinner together. Did that help? Okay. I'll get to there. Okay. But I think, just obviously, the magic of Pollock and Twombly, right, is exactly how they strike us. They do everything. I mean, think about, let me just on the same page here. They are exactly trying to make sure that we cannot see their paintings as purposes, right? They do everything possible to make sure that there's no conceivable purpose that we can find in their objects. And yet we find them purposive. That is, complex integrated forms, right? So that it's as if they were reading Kant, right? And they thought, well, how do we make this work, right? And free beauty has to be so that no intention can impose itself on the viewer's take. So what I'm going to do is eliminate all those features of painting that could be ascribed as directly intentional. So I'm going to throw, I'm going to spatter, I'm going to spill, I'm going to scribble. And yet, it's nonetheless going to appear as certainly purposive. What purpose? No conceivable. That's the paradigm. As would be a tulip.
Tulip is the same thing.
Tulip is just a small pulse. That grows. And by the way, just so we are, it will be important later, but Kant talks about tulips a lot. And tulips, you know, insult intended, were not little bits of Dutch culture when Kant dealt with them. They were just newly imported from Turkey, which is where tulips are natural, and they were therefore the paradigm of a wildflower that was being introduced to Europe at the time. So when you see all the references to tulips, he's actually thinking, he's talking about something that is really primitive and natural and wild, and not, you know, the artifact of lots of serious Dutch planters. I insulted you enough for a minute? Okay.
The fact that it's wild sort of underscores this idea that it has no purpose because nobody's designed it to be a certain way after.
I'll say more about the wild, but yeah, it's trying to disabuse us of the possibility of intention, of purpose, that it's cultivated and made to do this or that job, right? So the context of Kant's analysis is purposiveness is introduced into the analysis of a universally communicable pleasure in a mental state of the free harmony occasioned by reflection upon an object, which entails that, and here's the entailment, that it is mentally, subjectively purposive, not because of its form, but because it enhances the reciprocal activity of the imagination and the understanding. So the thought here is this. The object, which is going to be construed as purposive, is only purposive as apprehended, right? And it is purposive for the harmony between the imagination and the understanding, right? That is, when I say it's purposive for them, remember that it is in this section in paragraph 10 that Kant states that consciousness of a presentation's causality directed at the subject state so as to keep him in that state, right? They here designate generally what we call pleasure. So it is purposive for the keeping of us in that harmonic state, right? And that is the source of pleasure, and that pleasure we know occurs because being in that state is generally purposive for cognition in general. So the notion of purposiveness here is being used in at least three ways. I think there are ways of doing this where it comes out four times. But it is at least being used in these three senses, that there's a form of purposiveness, which is for the sake of the relationship between understanding and imagination. That is, they find that it keeps them in that state of pleasure. So purposiveness, too, is the pleasure of that state of harmony. And that state of harmony matters to us Kant will say in paragraph 21, because being in that state is propedeutic to cognition in general, or a necessary condition for cognition in general, or some such thing. That's the whole question of the deduction. But okay. Let's take a break there, and I'll come back and talk about Kant's formalism and all the issues around it. It's 9:15. Yeah, let's have a break there.